With the sun setting on a primary season full of surprises, expect more of the unexpected as we head toward the party conventions. This hour, Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer with this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Along with my co-host this hour, Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette, we're coming to you from CSPS in Cedar Rapids in an event recorded before a live audience. Our guests for this edition, Gazette political investigative reporter James Lynch, along with Gazette columnists Todd Dorman and Linda Waddington. Their thoughts on the Iowa races and, of course, the race for the White House. Pints and Politics just ahead. First, this news. No doubt the 2016 campaign season will be studied for years by political scientists. In fact, it may go down in history as a significant turning point in our country's politics and history. With just about 150 days before November's general election, what does all this political surprise and tumult mean for Iowa, for the nation? I'm Ben Kiefer. This is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, coming to you from CSPS in Cedar Rapids.
And I'm Jennifer Hemmingson with the Gazette, and we're very excited to partner with Iowa Public Radio for this round of Pints and Politics. And a special thanks to CSPS and Legion Arts for hosting us in this beautiful space.
Very nice.
We are just tickled to be joined by our esteemed panel tonight, Gazette political and investigative reporter James Lynch. Gazette columnist Linda Waddington. And Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. So, panel, at our last Pints in Politics, we were a couple days out before the official wrap-up of the legislative session. Any final comments, any hits or misses? You want to put it all in the past?
Yes.
What legislative session? I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's a distant memory. I think the only thing that was left hanging then was whether the governor would veto anything. His vetoes were minimal, and he really didn't veto any money this year, so it was kind of anticlimactic.
What do you think about the water quality issue, the governor's proposal about getting money to improve Iowa's water quality, panel?
Oh, they all look at me for some reason.
Todd Dorman.
Well, it was... He put it out there in the condition of the state address, and then it sort of languished and never really... I mean, his plan was to use part of the sales tax that had traditionally gone for school infrastructure. He wanted to use the growth from that and extend the tax to 2049. There wasn't a lot of appetite in the legislature for using that school infrastructure tax to fund water quality, so they came up with other plans. The House had a plan. The Senate didn't like it. The Senate's plan didn't go anywhere. The notion of raising the sales tax to fill the fund that was created in 2010 by voters didn't go anywhere because it was election year, and raising taxes is sort of the kryptonite that a lot of lawmakers don't want to go near. And so we don't have a new funding mechanism for water quality. I mean, one of the other problems is that we don't, there was a lot of debate over how to spend up new money, but there was no plan for exactly how it would be spent. I mean, what the thresholds would be, what the guidelines would be, what the goals would be of spending a bunch of new money on water quality. So in the end, they walked away.
And Linda, I think I've heard you say that you're in favor of maybe a little bit more simple approach, and that is putting a little bit more of the responsibility on the farmers and the landowners. Is that something you want to talk a little bit about?
Well, I think if we're going to raise sales tax, that we need to raise sales tax equally. And right now we have so many exemptions, and a lot of those have to do with farming, that I don't think it's quite fair to make the person who's working a minimum wage job raising two kids kick in that much in sales tax when farmers aren't kicking in the same. So if we're going to do it sales tax, I would like to see it be a more equitable system. I'd like for them to review all those sales tax exemptions.
Mm-hmm. What else from this past legislative session before we move on to more current politics? The end of the legislative session now several weeks behind us. Any other reflections?
I think one thing that a feeling that gets stronger every year as I watch the legislature is as much as they try to deny it, they are becoming more and more like Congress. They always start and end the session with speeches saying like, well, at least we're not like those Washington folks, you know, that can't get anything done. And then at the end of the session, it's like, but you didn't get anything done. And which is really unfortunate because they don't address things like water quality or, you know, education funding, whether it's adequate or not. They don't address mental health issues that should be addressed. And they just can't find common ground on those things.
Speaking of mental health issues, our governor, in his ultimate wisdom, pulled another unilateral decision to close the PMIC down at Independence. And maybe that needed to be done, but once again, we have a decision being made by the executive branch without having a discussion by the people, by the lawmakers, or really anyone other than him and the people that he appointed. And I think that's really sad for the children of Iowa who depended on that facility. And the fact that it has been sitting vacant since July and we have been paying for it just so we could make a point, so we could close it, is absolutely shameful.
All right, well, let's move a little bit closer to the primary. We just had a pretty interesting primary. Thoughts and processes on the results before we get to specific races?
I would just say I was really surprised at the turnout. Primary elections don't generally get a big turnout. But, you know, competitive U.S. Senate race on the Democratic side, competitive races in the 1st, 3rd, and 4th congressional districts, plus some legislative races and, like, in places like Linn County, some local races that were competitive. And yet, this was the lowest turnout since 2004, less than 10% of Iowans voted in the primary, which, you know, we can probably think of a lot of reasons why that might contribute to that, but it still means they didn't vote, and they're not participating, and yet after November 8th, we'll all be complaining about the results.
Yeah. Just a quick show of hands, how many of you voted in the primary?
Let's see. Jennifer, if I can jump in here for our radio audience, applaud if you voted in the primary.
10%.
No,
or maybe this
here.
Is the 10%. We have the entire primary electorate right here. Thanks for coming.
We do. Well, Todd and Linda, has anyone talked to you about why they did or did not show up for the primary? Are people just sick of it?
I think on the Republican side in Linn County, there really wasn't much to determine. They think they had one competitive race, third district supervisor, and so if you didn't live in that district, there really wasn't anything for you to decide. Mm-hmm. So that tamped down turnout on the Republican side.
Well certainly the race that's catching some national attention is Patty Judge will be facing Chuck Grassley, who has been a senator since I was a sophomore in high school. You can't see that on the radio. I've got pretty gray hair. What's left of it, that is. So running for his seventh term, Chuck Grassley, is this, in your estimation, the most vulnerable he's been because of the Supreme Court vacant ninth seat controversy panel?
Yes. Every year we hear about Chuck Grassley and we hear that he's vulnerable, and this is the year. This is the year that we're going to be able to end the Teflon man, and it doesn't happen. I don't expect it to happen again this year.
Was Patty Judge the one who has the best chance at beating Chuck Grassley?
I'm not supposed to say this in Linn County because everyone here likes Rob very much, and I like Rob very much as well.
Your hometown boy.
But yes. But he did not have the name recognition statewide that Patty Judge has, and hopefully he will use that name recognition he's earned to perhaps pursue other pursuits.
Yeah. Pursue other pursuits?
I think the race sort of, on a larger scale, is indicative of the problem of political parties where the Democrats saw an opportunity because of the Supreme Court vacancy and because of Chuck Grassley saying, I'm not going to hold hearings, we're going to wait for the next president. They said, oh, we need to get somebody in. This is our chance. This is the time we're going to beat him. And so they looked around and they said, Patty Judge is the person. They, you know, got her to run. They gave her some money so she could run TV advertising. I mean, she has a lot of name recognition, but she hasn't been on the ballot since, what, 2010? It's not like she's been out front and center on anything since then. And this isn't specific to the Democratic Party, but both parties have this problem that they don't have deep benches, really. And so when there is an opportunity, instead of looking at a fresh face like a Rob Hoag or somebody like that, they turn to kind of the elder statesman or stateswoman and say, we'll run them out there again. Mm-hmm. And she had the name recognition to win, but I don't know that it's going to matter in November.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's tough to have a deep bench when you're in a state where the governor serves six terms and the senators serve our entire lives. And I mean, yes. Even in Congress, we don't have a ton of turnover. And I'll say this about Patty Judge. I mean, I've seen a lot of Democratic candidates in my life who are lawyers from cities. And I mean, that would count Rob Hoag as a lawyer from a city. And I think Rob ran a great campaign. But it will be interesting to see if they break out of that mold with someone who has a rural background to run against a candidate who has basically, carved his entire image out of the fact that he's a farmer and he used to drive an old car and he has a lawnmower and he's sort of this, homespun guy. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see someone run against him that can sort of run a similar sort of campaign. Now, granted, she was lieutenant governor for a governor who was defeated after one term, and I think we all know that's what the Grassley folks are going to focus on, is that the Culver administration, big debt, Chet, mm-hmm. We've heard that from Branstad. Mm-hmm. The film office, the budget deficits that are probably a little larger according to Republicans than they actually were. But I mean, they're going to tie her to the Culver administration. And I mean, Judge's argument is going to be, this guy has been in Washington since the 1970s. And I think there is sort of a feeling among, voters that, Washington is broken, and I mean, can we keep sort of sending the same people back and expect it to get better? But I think actually that argument would have been a little bit better with Rob Hoag, who was a genuine outsider, mm-hmm. than Patty Judge, who's been in public office for the better part of the last 20 years.
So do you all think that Patty Judge is running to win? Do you think she's running to run for something else, or do you think she's running as a favor for somebody? Make Chuck spend a little bit of his cash?
I would say A and C,
okay.
That
yeah.
She's running to win and as a favor to somebody, to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. They want somebody in there that's going to make Chuck work hard. And the error in that, in my opinion, is that I think Rob Hoag would have made him work harder. Because Rob Hoag...
Oh, yeah, it was a... Yeah.
Rob Hoag would be out there every day from last Wednesday to November 8th, really going after Chuck Grassley. And I think he would run the sort of campaign that might force Chuck Grassley to make a mistake. Say something that he shouldn't say something that he doesn't mean, to take a position that he, wouldn't want to take if he had been thinking about it. But I don't see that... the intensity there in the judge, in Patty Judge, that she's going to run that sort of an intense, aggressive campaign that a Rob Hoag would have, or a Tom Fegan would have run.
Let me remind our public radio, Iowa Public Radio listeners, that this is Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with co-host Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette. We're talking with Gazette political reporter James Lynch, Gazette columnist Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, saying goodbye to the primaries in 2016. Going to be saying hello to the party conventions, and we are about 150 days from the general election. To finish up our primary discussion, let's talk about a couple of the other interesting races. The first and the third congressional district, Monica Vernon will run against first-term Representative Rod Blum, the Republican in the first district, and in the third district we'll have Jim Maurer on the Democratic side facing first-term Republican David Young. Thoughts on these two races? How competitive are they really? You've got first-term representatives, I guess. That's why they're seeing nationally as potential vulnerable candidates, huh?
The first district, Democrats are very enthusiastic about regaining that seat because they have a huge, about 26,000 voter registration advantage. This is a district that went for President Obama twice, so they think their chances there are very good. On the other hand, Blum is an incumbent, and incumbents get reelected more than 90% of the time. So Vernon, I don't think, is the favorite there, but she certainly has a good chance.
Yeah, and I think with Monica, the last time around, we had three very ambitious and wonderful women who were running for that office that kind of split those votes. And we saw what happened when we didn't have those women doing that this time around. I think Monica is where she should have been previously. So I think that's going to be a good race. I think it's going to be a race where you're going to see a lot of money flowing in from the national parties, from the Republican Congressional Committee, from the Democratic Congressional Committee. We've already seen Emily's List, Neural, several different women's groups try to have a push there. I think everyone can smell that, you know, there's a little blood in the water in the first district. Mm. Well, no, I did not go there.
Cackling with glee here.
Well, I'm just going to sit back until the break.
Comments perhaps about the third district. Jim Maurer facing David Young, and the fact that, you know, Democrats are sensing not only that they can flip the U.S. Senate, but also the U.S. House of Representatives. Is that realistic, well, in addition to the White House holding on to it?
That's the place where, you know, you talk about the bench and the young up-and-comers. I mean, Jim Maurer is a young up-and-comer. He's an Iraq War veteran. He ran in the 4th District and, I mean, did his duty and tried to knock out Steve King, and that's pretty tough to do, and he fell short. But you know, like a Rob Hogue, he received a lot of praise for the campaign he ran. And so he came to the 4th District. I think there was some, the conventional wisdom was that Mike Sherzan was sort of the guy to beat. He was the best organized, but Maurer won. And I think David Young's got quite a challenge on his hands. I mean, they always say that if you're going to beat an incumbent, you need to beat an incumbent on their first try for reelection. And that's what Democrats are going to try to do in the 3rd.
We talked a little bit about Patty Judge and about the sort of long road ahead of her. And an audience member wants to know what you all think of Grassley's comments regarding Judge Sotomayor in defense of Trump's comments. And is that going to come back? Is that going to have any kind of impact on this race?
Yeah, I think it'll be brought back up, thrown back up at Chuck Grassley repeatedly through the campaign. It was sort of a odd comparison to make. And he, after that interview, he said that he wasn't trying to equate the two, you know, Donald Trump's comments with Justice Sotomayor's comments. But it was just sort of this odd juxtaposition of saying, well, you know, on the one hand, Donald Trump said this and she said that. And obviously he was prepared because he had the quote. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't quoting her off the top of his head. So it was something that he had thought about and making that comparison. And yes, it will come back.
Well, I don't know what a wise Latina would have said to Chuck Grassley, but I think Chuck should have just not gone there. I mean that's the whole problem with sort of, you know, trying to be kind of for Trump but also kind of deeply concerned about Trump, and you try to explain what he's saying, and Chuck Grassley got his, you know, got tangled up, and then he tried to sort of say, well, yes, he says that this judge from the Mexican born in Indiana is is, which is some trick, and is can't be impartial, and so, you know, Chuck Grassley tried to say, well, you know, this is an example of a Supreme Court justice saying that she's not impartial either, which, I mean, was a lead balloon. And mm-hmm. I mean, and as I say, that's the problem. You need, if you're going to be for Trump, you kind of have to be for Trump, and if you're not going to be for Trump, you sort of have to be against him. This dance that a lot of people are doing, sort of trying to be for and against him, isn't going to work all the way till November. I mean, Chuck Grassley's going to face tons of questions all the time because he has sort of expressed his support for the nominee. It's a stone around his neck as long as Donald Trump keeps saying outrageous things, and I think we know that he probably will.
You're saying he hasn't fallen in love with a teleprompter. He hasn't fallen in love with a teleprompter.
Well, isn't that ironic? I mean, now the teleprompter is a mark of presidential responsibility. I mean, whereas before it was this horrible thing.
Weakness. Yes.
So
what about the idea while we're on this? So many Democrats jumped into the race. Patty Judge will be the Democratic nominee because of the Supreme Court controversy over the vacant ninth seat. What about the crux of this and the two sides of it? One side says, Chuck Grassley, do your job. The other side, Chuck Grassley's side, would say, listen, not holding hearings, not holding a vote is within my constitutional authority as the chair of the Judiciary Committee. And that's fully within my rights. Inside that idea of advise and consent, I can do nothing. And that's advising and consenting or not consenting.
Yeah, Chuck Grassley is making a gamble. And we don't know yet if it's going to pay off for him or not. It could very well be Hillary Clinton's White House in January. And so the only thing, if that happens, the only thing that Chuck Grassley has accomplished is leaving the court to eight people who evenly split, who end up kicking stuff back down to the lower court and accepting that ruling, and leaving a patchwork of laws across the nation. And Chuck Grassley will have to answer for that. I don't know if it will be this election so much, but it's going to come back to bite him. It's going to be part of his legacy.
Oh, I want to ask this question from one of our audience members here. Does the fact that there will be so many uncontested seats in the Iowa House and Senate suggest democracy is on the wane in Iowa? Wow, there's a question.
I think it suggests that we have a very strong two-party system where they don't want to spend money on races where they don't see a possibility of winning. I was looking today, Bobby Kaufman, the son of Jeff Kaufman, the state Republican chairman, does not have a Democratic opponent. Mary Masher, who's a very well-known Democratic lawmaker down in Iowa City, does not have a Republican opponent. And it's kind of like the parties have written those races off. Oh, we can't win these. Why should we invest funds in those? Let's invest them somewhere where it's more competitive. And that's unfortunate, because what happens is Bobby Kaufman does not have to answer questions, and Mary Masher doesn't have to answer questions. They can give money elsewhere. They can help people who may not be as good of lawmakers as we would like them to be. So, yeah, I mean, it's a problem. I don't know how we solve it exactly. But I think we should be looking at it and looking for more people to run in those seats.
Hear, hear.
We may have to have a relocation of Republicans from Northwest Iowa to Johnson County. sort of a refugee program. And maybe Democrats to Northwest Iowa. You know, you bring a bunch of Iowa City Democrats up to Sioux Center. And then we'll have more competitive races. Those districts will suddenly get purple. But I'll leave the details to be worked out by somebody else.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Pints and Politics before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. When we come back, we'll talk about the general election to come in about 150 days, if you can believe that, before the November elections. When we come back, we'll talk. In fact, I'll ask our panelists how different it is from previous presidential elections in our lifetimes, and what does Trump's popularity, what does Bernie Sanders' popularity tell us about the mood of the nation? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, back before this live audience in Cedar Rapids in just a moment. Special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. This edition, Pints and Politics. We're coming to you live from CSPS in Cedar Rapids before a sizable audience of people who are political junkies. They have come. I'm here with my co-host, Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette, and they have come to hear the insights and the punditry, if I can put it that way, of Gazette political reporter James Lynch, along with Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman, columnist for the Gazette. I'm sorry if punditry insulted anyone there. But, this half hour. Jennifer, this half hour, we're going to turn to presidential politics, right? We have about 150 days until our general election.
Mm-hmm. 150 long and grueling days.
So we want to talk about that. What do we want to know from our panelists first and foremost?
Well, I'm kidding, of course. We love it. And our audience has got a number of really great questions here. So we're going to start out with the logical place, the libertarians.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a lot of push for some sort of alternative. And Gary Johnson is back, and he's been polling above 11%. So this audience member wants to know, what are the chances that he'll get to 15%? And if so, are we going to see three people in October's presidential debates?
That would be a treat, but and especially if Gary Johnson is there, it would be a treat. Because Gary's a little bit of a wild card. I remember when Gary Johnson was a Republican and came to Cedar Rapids campaigning for the Republican nomination back in, what was that, 2008? And that didn't work out, and he was very libertarian at the time, and I think he's just sort of followed his true nature. It's interesting, when I talk to people, they talk about they want an alternative, but I think a lot of people don't know enough about libertarians to know if that's the alternative they're looking for. And I guess he's got 150 days to make that case. I have a suspicion that if Gary Johnson gets to like 14%, they'll probably move the goalpost to like 17.5.
Right. I mean, that's an interesting ticket. You know, you've got Gary Johnson. He was governor of New Mexico for, I think, 2 terms.
Yes. Yeah.
And where he was known for vetoing tons of legislation. I think he had, in the hundreds of vetoes. And
then Jeb Bush would say he was Vito Corleone.
Vito Corleone. That's right. That's Jeb's line. And he's, the vice presidential nominee is William Weld, who was, a two-term, or at least a one- or two-term governor of Massachusetts, ran for the Senate and lost. But these are, guys that have been governor of states. I mean, it's not like they're just some dude that's a, libertarian from somewhere, right, and has never held public office or doesn't have any experience. I mean, these are real politicians, and I would love to see them get on a debate stage because I think they've got interesting stuff to say that's a lot different than what Donald Trump, I don't know how many people they would insult, but and Hillary Clinton would have to say. So,
and the point Todd's making is that they have the experience. These are libertarians who are calling for more than just recreational marijuana. I mean, their agenda is much broader than that. They've governed. They kind of know what they're talking about.
Although I read an essay that a libertarian had written, and I forget what publication it was in, but this was a person that was worried that they would be too successful, because then if they actually got votes and had to be in the debates, they would have to start like saying things to get votes, which would pollute sort of the purity of libertarianism. And it's like, okay, well, maybe it is a sort of a club to be in, but that's the problem. Success will dilute your message. That's the reality of politics.
If you just joined us, James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington of the Gazette, Ben Kiefer here with my co-host, Jennifer Hemmingson. Let's talk a little bit about the conventions that are coming up, if we could. We have now our presumptive nominees. We assume they will become the nominees. Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side and Donald Trump on the GOP side. At least two of you are going to cover the conventions, right? Speak up.
All three of us are.
All three of you going. Where are you going, Linda?
I'm going to the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia along with James Lynch.
Okay.
Todd, you're going to Cleveland?
I'm going to Trumpapalooza. It's going to be...
Okay.
It's going to be big and beautiful and huge.
tell me your thoughts. You're going to be on the spot where we have two very interesting conventions. Bernie Sanders, to this date, has not given up the fight, even though he did not get enough delegates when combined with superdelegates, the pledged delegates. So what are you expecting? What are your questions as you look forward to visiting these conventions and covering them for the Gazette?
Well, I think a lot is going to depend on what Bernie Sanders does between now and the convention, how strong his embrace of Hillary Clinton is, if there is an embrace of Hillary Clinton. More than that, maybe, is what his followers do, his supporters. Are they going to accept Hillary Clinton as the nominee? Are they going to embrace her platform? Or, I mean, I can foresee a real fight at the convention with the, you know, Sanders followers trying to influence the platform, trying to push Hillary Clinton farther towards the left or the progressive viewpoint. So the race may be over, but I don't think the fight is over.
Yeah, and I think the concessions that can be offered to Bernie Sanders really aren't concessions. I think they're just kind of fake things to make people feel better, for lack of a better terminology. The platform doesn't actually mean anything. No one has to follow it. You don't have to have a certain percentage of the bills that you introduce in your state house or Congress aligned to that platform. You know, it's something the grassroots does. It's something that the leader at the time can influence to kind of bolster where they want to go, but not typically something that bubbles up from the bottom in the other direction. The other things I've heard talk about are superdelegates that will do away with superdelegates. Bernie Sanders people need to be very careful if they agree to that, because the reason the superdelegates exist was to create more room for grassroots people to go to that national convention. So these are your elected officials, your DNC personalities, those types of folks that automatically get to go. If those have to come back down, they're going to be competing against average grassroots supporters here in Iowa and going to those conventions. The third thing I've heard is open primaries. Bernie Sanders people really want a lot of open primaries. You're talking about 50 different state regulations that would need to be passed, and the DNC has no control over that. So I'm not sure exactly what concessions come out of this for Bernie Sanders supporters. Maybe we see Bernie Sanders himself get a cabinet, or people have talked about vice president, or other, you know, accommodations for what he's already accomplished, and he's accomplished a great deal. The first time I saw Bernie Sanders was in a tiny, I don't even know what it exactly was, a tiny venue in Goose Lake, Iowa. The Clinton County Democrats came there. The Goose Lake is about population of 200. That night, we doubled the population of the town. And I was one of two members of the press there that first trip into Iowa and got to sit down and speak with him for probably 30 minutes. And to come from that spot to where you have CNN and everyone else following you around, he has made incredible accomplishments, and his supporters have been incredibly supportive. So, I mean, he has a lot to be proud of, and maybe he needs to think on that and where he already is and where he wants to go, more than maybe concessions that don't actually mean anything.
Yeah, Todd's going to the GOP convention. What are your thoughts, Todd?
Yeah, you know, for a while there, it looked like it might be contested, and then people started coalescing around Donald Trump, and now in the last week or so with the remarks he made about Judge Curiel and people thinking about, you know, what that means. And now, you know, you're hearing some delegates and some people talk about, you know, maybe we should refuse to vote for him, and maybe we should try to, you know, get enough delegates together to deny him the nomination. So I think it's pretty fluid. I mean, and with the Trump campaign, a week is a lifetime, so you have no idea exactly what, by July 18th, what the lay of the land is going to look like. But I think the one thing you know, and I think the one thing that the Cleveland Police Department believes is that there's going to be a lot of protesting, and there's going to be people arrested, and it's going to be a fairly contentious scene. So I haven't looked into how much a gas mask costs online, but, you know, I...
So a couple of questions about, you know, the Donald when he becomes the official nominee. A question from the audience about, you know, his penchant for speaking off the top of his head. And there have been some stories about some disorganization within his campaign. Will he get some support from the party? Will he accept some support from the party? Will we start to see a more traditional kind of campaign and candidate after he gets the crown?
Well, it's a two-way street, because the presidential nominee is expected to raise money that trickles down to all of the other, you know, campaigns, Senate campaigns, House campaigns. And there hasn't been a really good sign that he's willing to do that. So, I mean, it's hard to believe that Donald Trump may just sort of be in this for himself. You know, I find that difficult to believe. But the idea, I mean, because, you know, usually your nominee is sort of the leader of a larger coordinated campaign, And I'm not sure this time around that that's the case. And that's going to be a big bone of contention. Is this guy who's the billionaire and who is self-financing, so to speak? I mean, is he going to be willing to raise the money that you normally would for a presidential campaign that then assists other campaigns?
And he's saying that he doesn't think he needs to raise $1 billion to run a presidential campaign, that he can do it on less.
$1 billion worth of free media.
It's worked so far.
Cable networks, yeah,
it's worked
exactly.
So far. The other thing that's really interesting is I was talking to delegates to the GOP convention today, and they accept that Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. He's got the delegate votes he needs, but they're not on board. They're just like, well, yeah, he'll be the nominee, but as one guy told me, he said, I'm not in the Never Trump group, but yeah, I'm just not there. And I think there's a lot of them. And so, this idea that that the nominee is the leader of the party, there's a lot of people who don't want to follow that leader.
What could this possibly mean for the future of the Republican Party?
Well,
I mean, people have talked about a split.
After the 2012 race, there was this post-mortem that the Republican National Committee did and tried to say, what do we do wrong? What do we need to learn? What do we need to do differently? After this election, I think they're going to have to reexamine that again. And maybe it will be a split. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine a third party emerging from this. But, I mean, just given that two parties have really dominated for so long. But I think a lot of people, sort of establishment Republicans who are, party people, are going to say, wait a minute, maybe we need to vet these candidates and find out if they're really Republicans before we let them participate. Do they share any of our values, our ideas? And that's not real appealing either, to have sort of this closed sort of process. But you have Donald Trump, who has come along and sort of hijacked the Republican Party.
I think Trump is going to be the great definer. He's going to define Republicans for many years to come. Who was with him? Who was against him? Who fought the nomination? Who didn't? I think that's going to be sort of a label that a lot of Republicans are going to have to wear going forward. I mean, of course, depending on his success or if he turns out to be a disaster, as the numbers sometimes indicate he could be in swing states. But where did you stand on that when push came to shove and this guy was up for the nomination? I mean, where were you? What role did you play?
Isn't it the conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks who has said this is a McCarthy moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty accurate.
And back in March of 2015, so back when Donald Trump was still a birther and a novelty, I was writing about UKIP, which is the United Kingdom Independence Party, and the correlation between the things that they held as values and what I was seeing on the ground here in Iowa. So, for instance, you would go talk to a Democrat, and that Democrat would say, I'm a pro-gun Democrat, but they still identified with the party. Or you talk to a Republican, and they would tell me, I'm a pro-life Republican, so they would still identify with the party. But this time around, I don't hear Democrat and Republican as much. I hear libertarian populist or progressive libertarian or, any number of these combinations that people come up with to describe themselves. And I think at the end of the day, there's going to have to be a split. And I really think the split that we're going to see first is going to be something that very closely aligns with those independence parties that we're already seeing in Britain. Because when you look at their values, they just stack right up with what we're seeing here in the United States that we're calling anger and angst and these other things that are supporting both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
And that's been a little bit of the question on the Democrat side, right? I mean, so Sanders supporters still concerned that the system is not fair, that their candidate is being given short shrift, increasingly people calling on Sanders to just step down to endorse Hillary. Where's this all going to land? Are Bernie supporters going to stay engaged? Are they just going to stay home? Is he going to be able to convert his revolution into, or is he going to be folded into the Democratic Party, and is he going to want to?
Tuesday night, I told you I was in Wichita. I was there for a conference. and we were actually at a tavern. And I, go figure, I know. But I like to play trivia on Tuesday nights, but now I feel the need to justify. But we were at this tavern in Wichita, and we were watching, you know, different results come in. I was getting to learn a little bit about the races there in that part of the country. And actually, I was waiting for Hillary Clinton to come on stage because I knew that this was going to be something that I wanted to see. So we all, when that started, CNN was on, and I moved closer to the TV at the bar. The first time I looked around me, there were two other women. The next time I look around, there was a group of women who were gathered around this monitor. And for all of us, and this is like age 21, maybe to 60 that were there that night. And for every one of us, this was a moment. And it didn't matter so much that it was Hillary Clinton. It mattered more that it was a woman meeting this pinnacle and that we had finally made it to this place. And, you know, there were tears in those eyes around the bar that night, which is kind of funny. But to be sitting around a bar and crying over a political event at a sports bar is kind of unusual. But there in Wichita, that's what we were doing.
Was it the same sort of feeling you had when Joni Ernst was elected? She was... No. If we're being nonpartisan and we're just saying we're proud of the fact that we can elect women, let's ask this question because Iowa was a laggard, one of the last states to elect women to Congress.
The night that Joni Ernst was elected, I was here in Cedar Rapids, and I was tipping back a brew in her honor because it did not matter to me if it was Joni Ernst or Patty Judge or Monica Vernon or whomever it might be. You know, maybe one day Samantha Waddington, who's my 16-year-old daughter. The fact that we made it to that place, that Iowa was no longer tied with Mississippi as the only state that hadn't elected a woman to Congress, was super. I don't agree with everything Hillary Clinton espouses. I don't agree with everything that Joni Ernst espouses. But I can still celebrate the fact that I see Iowa progressing and I see our nation progressing in a way that they should be. So it was a great night.
Well, we're listening to Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman and James Lynch of the Gazette, and we're before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette, my co-host here. With Jennifer, with your permission, I'd like to do a little sort of audio portrait of the electoral, experiences of our audience here, if I could. Let me try this out. Clap if you were of voting age in the year 2000, Bush v. Gore. Okay, let's work back. 1996, Clinton versus Dole. 1992, 88, 84, 80. 76 would have been Carter against Ford. 72, Nixon against McGovern. Wow, we're still holding on. 68, Nixon against Humphrey. Thinning out a bit. 64, Johnson against who? Goldwater. Ooh, we're getting thin here. 1960, who voted in that election or was a voting age? Kennedy against Nixon. There we go. We going back any further than that? 56? All right, there's our winner right back there. So, to follow up here, clap if you think in your lifetime this 2016 election is the most unusual campaign you have experienced. And as a follow-up, clap if you think this campaign has the most at stake for the presidential election in your lifetime. Okay, there you go. I don't know. Sort that out, panel. It's your job.
Well, but they do. Every 4 years they say it's the most important election. Is it true this time?
I think there are, you know, you can go back and find many elections where there are various factors that make it the most important election or a watershed election. Certainly, I think how we've gotten this far in this campaign really makes this different than other elections. Donald Trump is completely different than any other candidate I can remember. I think he's rewritten a lot of the rules. Hillary Clinton, we've never had a former first lady, former secretary, somebody who has her resume running as a major party candidate. So yeah, there are a lot of things that are going to make this election different, and it's the most important election in our lifetime.
I mean, you know, every election is the most important election because we don't have any idea what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, we elected George W. Bush because we thought he was the best guy to have a beer with, and then 9/11 happened. And, you know, if we had it to do over again, I'm not, you know, maybe we would have done it differently. But that's the thing about elections, is that it's always something. The election is never about what it needs to be about because we don't have any idea what's going to happen. And that's, we found that out time and time again.
Okay, River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Production assistance from John Pemble. The executive director of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you all for coming out, having a pint, discussing politics. Thanks to the Gazette. Thank you all. Have a good night.